All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome, thanks for coming over. It's a Monday morning, coming to follow lessons on Monday morning is very brave of all of you. To the people on the live stream, welcome as well. In this camp, what we're gonna do, we're gonna talk about two major topics. We're gonna talk about it general, not in depth on every topic. That would take us a couple of days, maybe even a couple of weeks. But we are going to look at all of the new functionality that is coming in Windows Server 2016, and new functionality that is existing today in Microsoft Azure, or is coming as well. Very important to know, especially with Microsoft Azure, and even with Windows Server 2016, is that you're gonna see that the way Microsoft is bringing out new releases, new features, is going to change. From the moment you're all going to be at 2016, and you can actually see that already with Windows 10, they're gonna be new builds, new updates. If you look at Windows 10, and you're one of those people that uses insider builds, then you see that new functionality comes with some updates. We always say jokingly that Windows 10 is the latest, that will always be called Windows 10, and it's just going to come with updates. Windows Server 2016 is going to do the same thing. It's just gonna bring new functionality piece by piece, bit by bit. And Azure, if you're gonna look at Azure, which goes way faster, does exactly the same thing. Today you have this functionality, then you have somewhere a beta, and then a new update comes, and it's over there, and it goes way faster. But we'll talk about that a little bit more, on how you're gonna have to handle that within your own environment as well. It's gonna be rather important. The 3-year update cycle, the way you're doing this probably today, you're gonna have to do a little bit more changing. You're gonna have to think differently about it. That being said, the first thing this morning is going to be about the data center infrastructure. So it's going to be about Windows Server 2016. So what's on our agenda for this first 1 hour, 1 hour and a half, more or less? We're gonna talk about what's new in Hyper-V. We're gonna talk about containers. You probably all already heard about containers. It's a buzzword. You can't go to any presentation or somebody is mentioning containers, or cloud for that matter. We're also gonna talk about NanoServer. NanoServer is going to be extremely important for the future, and it's certainly something you need to have a look at. What can it do for me? Where can I use it in my environment? Because this is going to be a very important part of many data centers. We're gonna talk about software-defined storage, another one of these buzzwords. But it's here, it starts to get there, and it starts to be possible to deploy it into your environments. Say about networking, and then, you know, at the end you have a resource slide if you wanna learn more. That being said, let's just start, and let's talk about Hyper-V, right? So what's new in Hyper-V? Let's look first at what we have in Hyper-V so far. I'm just gonna quickly click through these nice slides, but this is what exists in Windows Server 2012 R2. We're talking about 64 virtual CPUs per virtual machine. We're talking about 4 terabytes of RAM per host, 64 terabytes of VHDX. By the way, if you really have such a drive on it, you might wanna consider a few things. We're talking about networking, dynamic memory, live migration, the possibility to deploy Linux. It doesn't have to be Windows on its own, which is rather important in many environments. Hyper-V replica, 64 node clusters, generation 2, and so on and so on. Important to know is that many of the functionality that came in 2012 and 2012 R2 could be considered as it's there, but it's not final. I'm missing this functionality, I'm missing this functionality. And you're right, it wasn't completely ready, some functionality was missing, and couldn't replace certain technologies you were using today. 2016 just leverages on that. And again, you're gonna see this more and more of Microsoft. They're gonna give you some technology. We as customers are going to say, it's nice, but I'm missing A, B, C, and just going to get an update out there that will deliver that functionality. That's the new way they are working. And you also can see, if you look what they're doing today, and if you're one of those people that ever started with Virtual Server or with Hyper-V 2008, it's not what it was anymore. Microsoft, whether we like to laugh with it or not, saying always they're way behind of the competition VMware, but the last couple of years they really stepped up their game and they really increased everything they're bringing. In many cases, when people ask me, but today, if you have to choose between VMware and between Hyper-V, what would you tell me to choose if you don't look at the price? The answer to that is, as always in IT, it depends. In some cases where you really have these huge enterprises with diverse data centers, VMware might still have a slight advantage. But in most enterprises, if we see and they really tell me, this is what I need, this is what I need, this is what I need, and all the rest is optional, Hyper-V can deliver that exactly the same thing. And then it becomes a matter of, what do you know? How do you want to work? How are your IT staff? Because even though Microsoft is catching up, if you're already working in a VMware environment, then all of your IT professionals have been working with VMware. Switching them to Hyper-V might become a challenge. It's a new way of working, a new way of management. There's going to be a lot of PowerShell, and you'll hear that in throughout the entire day, is that PowerShell really is going to be extremely important. It also means if you are going to take that step to Windows Server 2016, and I hope you will, of course, considering what's coming, that you will need to have a look on how you're going to manage your service. And if you're going to change that management, then you will see that managing Hyper-V is going to be extremely easy because it's exactly the same thing. But do keep that in mind, because the most common mistake enterprises make is we've got our VMware crew that have been trained in VMware for 10 years, and then they get the ISO of Hyper-V and say, we want to change, go for it. What do these guys do, or these girls? They implement Hyper-V the exact same way as they would do VMware. That doesn't work. It's not the same. You need to change. So keep that in mind. If you are going to go to Hyper-V, if you're working with VMware, it is not the same. So you have to approach it differently. All right. This is built in. Now we're going to look what is coming in 2016. The first thing I want to talk about is about security. Now, I know this is another joke. There are only two people of Microsoft, so I guess they won't shoot me if I joke too much about Microsoft today. But one of the things a couple of years was Microsoft and security, two words you can't use in the same sentence. Now, if you're going to look at the last 2 years, you're going to see it's not true anymore. If you really look at security, and I've got a couple of guys, by the way, I do not work for Microsoft, but I've got a lot of people responsible for security, the company I work for, and they're Russians. You know, Russians and security, if there's a hole, they find it. They're very good at that. Those guys really see that Microsoft stepped up their game on one condition, if you keep yourself up to date, of course. But if you look at 2014 and 2015 in the open source community, how many holes and how many security risks there were, and still are because they don't get patched, then Microsoft is actually doing a great job. Doesn't matter that we still see a lot of incidents. If we look at cyber attacks, if we look at malware things, especially ransomware. I don't know if you already have seen it, but I can assure you, I work for a backup vendor, so we see a lot of those that have issues and need to recover from backups. But there's a lot of issues, and most of these threats are not coming from the outside. They're actually coming from inside, by mistake, or really somebody inside the company that is doing something which he better should not do. But it happens, it exists. So the biggest issue here is this. If you're gonna look at how we built our data centers today and we are working with virtual machines, then what we've got our Hyper-V hosts, or a VMware host for that matter, and then we've got what we call tenant virtual machines. Why do we call them tenants? Because you have to look this from the point of view from Azure, where the Hyper-V host is the service provider Microsoft. You also can look at from the service provider, where you rent some space with your local service provider to run some virtual machines or even push some hardware inside. But you know, just look at your own data center exactly the same way. You've got your virtual machines which you deploy for the business, for your end users, and you are probably responsible here for the Hyper-V hosts. Now, what is the biggest threat as this guy? The Fabric Virtualization Administrator. And the reason for that is, I'll just leave it like that. If you have access to that Hyper-V host and you've got administrator access, I can get everything. If you are running one domain controller virtually, I can literally take a snapshot of that domain controller, copy the VHD, merge the snapshot, nobody saw it, and then I have tools enough at home where I can get every password in the infrastructure. That means, theoretically, if you think about it, that Microsoft can do exactly the same thing in Azure, that your service provider can do exactly the same thing and you've never known it. So the biggest risk is this guy, us. We can do whatever we want, we can get every password, we can tamper every virtual machine, we can play with it, right? So because of that, Microsoft is coming up with something they call Shielded Virtual Machine. The idea behind it is that we don't have access anymore to that virtual machine. We're still running it, but we can't get inside anymore. So how does it work? This is how it works today. If you look at the physical server, and if you, you know, are a bigger company, then you probably work with server administrators, storage administrators, network backup administrators, and so on. Smaller company, that's probably one person or a group of persons. But in the end, only the server administrator should have access to that physical machine. That would be the ideal. If you look at the virtual machine, all of these guys have access. Again, I work for a backup company. That means if I can take a backup of that virtual machine, then I've got a backup of a VHDX. I can get out of there whatever I want. Pretty easy, actually. It's not even that difficult. So we need to change that. The moment we're going to look and we're going to work with shielded virtual machines, and I'll come back to that encryption in a second, then all of these people won't have access anymore. They will run the fabrics, they will run the networks, but they won't be able to go inside. And then the server administrator, well, it will depend on how much he will get, yes or no, right? Now, if we're going to look at it, how are we going to do this? There are two ways. One is we're going to encrypt the virtual machine state and the data. So not only the VHDX. The VHDX is going to be completely BitLockered, which means that these people won't be able to open it, attach it, whatever they can do it. But the state as well, because if you have a running state which is not encrypted, you can still put a sniffer on it and try to get out whatever you want. So that will be encrypted as well. Besides that, there's going to be an external system, which called a host guardian system, that will need to trust the hosts. So even if I think I'm smart, you know, I'm a hoster, I want to cheat a bit, I've got one of my Hyper-V hosts, and you encrypted everything, why not run it on a host which is tampered with, where I can play with, where I can put some software on it and try to cheat and still break into that virtual machine. The idea behind the host guardian service is that it will look at those hosts and trust them or not, which means the moment a hoster or you inside your company or even Microsoft Azure is trying to cheat on the host guardian service won't trust that host anymore, and your virtual machine won't run on it anymore. Okay? Make sense so far? Okay, this is a nice animation, but in the end, what they're saying is the host asks for a key. If it doesn't have the key, it won't be able to run that virtual machine. And if the host guardian service does not trust that host, and if it's not healthy, it won't give that key. Okay? Now, to be able to do that, Microsoft had to make a lot of changes to the way the virtual machines work. To start with, from now you will have a virtual TPM. Everybody knows in here what TPM is? Probably most of your machines will have this as well, right? TPM means that you can do encryption and it's got a hardware chip in it, and that will do all the heavy lifting. Now in a virtual machine, you will have that virtual TPM that can do that as well. And that means now in a virtual machine, you can use BitLocker completely. What does it mean? Literally, try to get the VHDX, say, open, which you can do in every Windows Explorer, mounted, and it won't give you access unless you've got the keys, unless you got that. The configuration file of a virtual machine will be encrypted as well. Now, if you know today a configuration file of Hyper-V, you can just right-click, edit, notepad, and you can see what's in there. In 2016, that will be done. you won't be able to read it anymore. It will be, it's not really encrypted, but it's binary, so you can't read it anymore. And also the state, the running state is encrypted, I already said that. The moment you or a hoster or whoever is working with your virtual machine is going to live migrate, every traffic will be encrypted as well. So even there, you won't be able to sniff and try to get some passwords or whatever you need to do. host crash dumps, if your host would go down, encrypted as well, same reason. And a virtual machine crash dump is just turned off. Because that is another trick to get data out of it, read out the crash dump when it blue screens. Now, by default, that will be off with the shielded virtual machine. If you still want to enable it, maybe because it keeps crashing or you want to do some troubleshooting on it, it will automatically encrypt it as well. So everything will be unreadable for that fabric administrator. That means we don't have any access anymore. It does have its downsides. Think about the fact that you take a backup today of a virtual machine and you do some guest indexing inside. Suddenly, we can't do it anymore because we can't read it. So it does have downsides. It also means that if somebody goes on that host and wants to do some work inside the virtual machine with their console, it's not possible anymore. VM Connect.exe suddenly does not have access anymore to the virtual machine. So if you're going to use this, that also means that in case of troubleshooting, you need to be prepared. Because the things you probably use today to troubleshoot a virtual machine suddenly don't work anymore. Okay? Keep that in mind when you want to run this. But certainly for a hoster perspective and for a large public cloud, this can be very interesting. From an architecture point of view, how does it look? We've got a host guardian service, which is a completely different domain. And then you got your hoster Active Directory, or inside as well. So two different Active Directories, and they need to trust each other. See? Oops, sorry. So only when your host guardian service trusts the Active Directory of your hoster, you will be able to run these virtual machines. Otherwise, it won't work. As of today, as far as I know, we still need that virtual machine manager to get it working. Personally, I hope that we will be able to do it without virtual machine manager. But as of today, I believe in TP4, it's still the case that we need this. You also need to have TPM version 2 and a UEFI 2.3.1 BIOS. Well, it's not BIOS, but in your virtual machine. That also means that it won't work with your older virtual machines. It needs to be generation 2. And it needs to be at least, if I'm not mistaken, Windows 10 and, of course, Windows Server 2016. And I'm not sure if they're going to go one version back. We'll see. Don't forget, with 2016, we're still in technical preview. And what we've learned from their technical preview is in technical preview 1, they literally had nothing. Technical preview 2, something more came, and so on and so on. And we see they're growing. So there might still be a lot of changes. Everything I say here today, well, it might change by the time we go GA. I might say that that doesn't work, and the time GA, it already works. We don't know what they're doing in their offices over there. I'm not going to demo it, because the demo is rather stupid, takes 50 minutes, but what we're going to see is, literally, they're going to try to attach a virtual disk that is encrypted, and it will give a notification that it doesn't work, which is logical, of course, at that point in time. But there's more that they're building besides those virtual machines for availability. We're talking about virtual machine computer resiliency and storage resiliency. And what does it mean is, if you're running failover clusters today, one of the things that can happen is if there is a glitch in your network, if there's a small drop, automatically a failover will try to start. Sometimes it's literally 20 seconds that you have no network connection, which means recovering and bringing it back probably takes you way more work than if it wouldn't have failed over it. You have to think that Microsoft built failover clustering not for virtual machines that many years ago. What they did in 2016 is make sure that with failover clustering, that you can design it specifically for virtual machines, which means that at the moment there is an issue with your failover cluster, it won't fail over immediately. It will keep it running, but it will give you some new ways of seeing there's an issue. There will be degraded states. There will be quarantine states. It will go into pause. For example, if you have issues with your storage, and it could, again, it could be a small glitch, it will put it automatically in pause, not immediately try to fail over to something else. So for example, you've got one host. Let's say you got four hosts. Let's take the example of four hosts. And the host where your virtual machine is running on suddenly loses connection to the storage, whatever the reason is. Instead of trying to get it to another host immediately, it will put it into pause and wait for a certain amount of time. If we cross that time, that is configurable, by the way, to your own needs, then we will do the failover, right? The same for compute. It's perfectly possible that one of those hosts loses connection with the rest of the network or the rest of the clusters. It won't immediately move it. Or the other host won't say, I lost my host, it had five virtual machine nodes, I'll spin them up because I can't reach them anymore. Now, there are a few things, of course. One of them is node quarantine. If your host has been down, and I don't know it exactly out of my head, but I believe it has to go down 3 times in 1 hour or 1 hour, right? Today, again, configurable, that will say, okay, the node went down, came back up, went down, came back up, went down, there's something wrong. We'll quarantine the node, we'll make sure the virtual machines run somewhere else, and then it's up to the IT administrators to fix it. But in the end, you have to think is when you're going to design your 2016 failover clusters, you're going to get more possibilities to make sure that it doesn't start failovering when you actually don't want it. And one of the exercises you're going to do, and for the people on the live stream, you're not going to do the exercises, but it's after the break, is going to be literally cheat a bit and kill a host a couple of times to see how he is reacting and what the virtual machine is doing. And I think it's good. But I also think is that you really have to think very carefully on your timings. There are some defaults, but maybe they don't work for you. Maybe you need a bit longer. Maybe you think that's way too long. I want it slower. And something you're going to have to investigate in your own company. Okay. Some other thing is, and I'm really very excited about this, shared VHDX. It already existed in 2012 R2. So you could build guest clusters for virtual machines. So really get rid of those physical SQL servers you're still running or something like that. But there was a big problem with shared VHDX in 2012 R2. Number one was backup on a VM level, impossible. Resizing, if you were using Hyper-V replica, didn't work. So there were quite a few downsides, and what we saw was that it's interesting, but we're not going to use it. We're still using or pass-through disks or keep everything physical. They fixed those. Shared VHDX now will support backup, even if you do it on a virtual machine level, so it becomes just a VHD or a VHDX, exactly the same thing, which means portability, moving, live migrating those virtual machines that have that shared VHDX suddenly become possible rather easily. You're also going to have it resizing online. No more putting everything off, making it bigger, everything will be possible. And if you're using Hyper-V replica today, that will be supported now as well when you use shared VHDX. So this little thing, which they call much more, I believe is rather important to take that next step in virtualizing the rest of your data center. And it works rather well. Memory, even if you're running dynamic or you're running static memory, now you can do an online resize. Make it bigger, make it less. Do note that if you're running a virtual machine of 4 gigabytes, it's taking 2.5 and you want to resize it to 1 gigabyte of memory, that won't work. So you do need to know that in account. That being said, who's running dynamic memory at this point in time? One person. The rest static? I would advise you to really look into it. Dynamic memory works perfectly, and there's absolutely no downside compared to static. In fact, my entire data centers are running today on dynamic. One note, if you do this, look at the application inside the virtual machines. Because if you're running a SQL Server virtual, and you give it dynamic memory and say you can take whatever you want, guess what SQL does? Thank you. Becomes rather big. So make sure that the SQL is sized at that point in time. But it does work. Virtual NICs, finally, we can now add virtual NICs as much as we want while the machine is running. You will do an exercise on that as well. And then something really, really stupid, but will help you a lot into automation, is that you can finally choose the name of the NIC. Which means if you create the NIC outside of the virtual machine and you give it a name, that name will actually be visible inside the virtual machine. Especially if you use a lot of PowerShell and automation, this will help you quite a lot. So that works now as well. Rolling upgrades. If Microsoft says they're going to bring more and more updates to their operating systems, then we can't say that's nice, but every time I need to do an upgrade, I have downtime, I need to work in the weekends and the evenings. That's nice once every 3 years, but every 3 months, we probably don't want to do that. So one of the new functionalities coming is called rolling upgrades. So imagine you got today a Windows Server 2012 R2. Again, very simple, and I apologize for my bad drawing already, but imagine you've got very simple, told you I'm bad in drawing, 3 servers, right? And you run a couple of virtual machines on it, here as well, and maybe here too. What you can do with rolling upgrades is rather nicely is you're going to say, you know what, I've got the space, so I'm going to migrate one off. I'm going to migrate one off, which means this one is empty. Now you can upgrade the machine to 2016, remaining in the cluster. So now we have a cluster with 2 different operating systems, okay? You test it, you leave it running, depending on how you do your testing in your environment. And then you can say, you know what, I'm going to live migrate a couple of virtual machines to this box, make one empty, and do the second upgrade. Same story, third upgrade, until you've got a full 2016 cluster. Important to know at that point in time is that all of the virtual machines will remain in version 5. Version 5 meaning Windows Server 2012 R2. So all of the new functionality of 2016 does not come available for those virtual machines unless the entire cluster is upgraded and you decide it's time, let's upgrade it to 2016. Why is that? Well, very simple. If you're going to migrate some virtual machines to the 2016 box, you upgrade the virtual machines to the new functionality, then you don't have a way back to those 2012 in case something goes wrong. Okay? But that means without downtime, you can actually start doing those migrations and get everything to 2016. That does also mean that at a certain point in time, you are going to have to do, at least for now, manually say, upgrade my virtual machines. Theoretically, that would be version 6, but I believe we're at version 7 already in TP4, so it looks like we're going to skip a few versions, might even become bigger in the next technical previews or the GA. As long as the virtual machine has not been upgraded to the newest version, again, you cannot use that functionality. Can you use a version 7 virtual machine with a version 5 on the same node? You can. It's perfectly possible. But again, no additional functionality, okay? With that, something else comes as well, is that the virtual machine integration services, the way they're going to be delivered is differently. We all know, we all love it, go to the Hyper-V host, right-click, attach ISO, and then upgrade those integration services. They are now coming through Windows Update, which means your patching system better should be working as well. Now, there's still a lot of discussions. Didier was following that discussion as well, if I'm not mistaken, whether Microsoft is still going to deliver the executable or MSI or whatever you want to call it, so you can do the upgrade of the integration service manually without Windows Update. We don't know the answer yet. Although, if you know the website of Windows Update and you search on it, you can actually download them manually as well, so you might be able to do it. But for now, that's waiting until GA to see what's happening. So think about it. Your virtual machines will have to have access to Windows Update, and we'll just get those integration services exactly the same way as every other update that you do on your virtual machine. The only difference here is the Linux virtual machines. They don't have Windows Update, obviously. But most of those builds will have those integration tools already built in into the ISO, if you want to call it, like, or the distribution. Why is that? Microsoft is putting a lot of work into Linux, and they're actually building that already in into the distributions. There's still going to be builds where you're going to have to do something manually, but a lot of them have the tools in already. And then some operational efficiencies, and you're going to love those. Who's working with checkpoints? You know, Hyper-V Manager, checkpoint. Ooh. Theoretically, we all know Microsoft does not support it. In a production environment, when you do checkpoints, it's not supported. 2016, it's going to get supported. There are going to be two types of checkpoints, the one we know today, and the production checkpoints. And a production checkpoint is actually taking a snapshot the way backup vendors does it. The entire way of you're going to do backups in Hyper-V is going to change. Microsoft is going to go completely away from the VSS going to the VSS, so from the VSS to the host, going to the VSS in the guest. That system is completely changing. It's going to work now with WMI calls, APIs, and it's Microsoft who's now going to be responsible to do change block tracking and to make sure that snapshot works. That is a big advantage for backup vendors out there because they don't have to write their own kernel driver anymore, which means they don't have to write their own kernel driver anymore, less chance of having a blue screen. So it's a double win, both for the backup vendors, less work, and maybe they can bring, you know, some interesting stuff instead of writing on that driver, and for Microsoft, because less blue screens because of third-party vendors. Yeah, but that means production checkpoints, now you will actually be able to say, take a snapshot, take a checkpoint, do some work, it's all working, great, let's merge. Do take into account that if you leave that checkpoint open for a couple of days, it still will need to merge. Still can take some time, okay? But that said, I'll jump quickly now to REFS. If you're not using REFS yet today, I understand that. 2012 R2 REFS was not bad, but not ready for certain workloads. But in 2016, you should really consider running your virtual machines on REFS. Don't forget, on a Hyper-V host, your C drive will still be NTFS because we can't boot on REFS yet. But your data, where your virtual machines, if you're going to put it on REFS, you're really going to get a lot of advantages. For example, one of the things, if you create now a VHDX of 127 gigabytes, the standard, you say create, what you need to do, get a lot of coffee, come back, and hopefully it's done. REFS completely works differently and works with metadata, which means you're going to do the same thing, and a couple of seconds later, you have a 127 gigabyte fixed hard drive. Ready. Now, if you take that into consideration and you think about these checkpoints, and you know, we've got a VHDX, and the moment we take a snapshot, what happens is we get a VHDX, which is running everything on here. So every write is getting here, and this one is kind of locked, so you can do some things with it, do a backup, do an export, whatever you want to do, it's possible. Now, in the case of NTFS, what happens is all of these blocks need to get merged in here, which can take quite a while if you took the snapshot for a couple of hours. With REFS, we just move metadata, which means that block move does not need to happen anymore, and that snapshot merge will be much quicker. Suddenly, if this works well, and to be honest, the tests we are doing today, it seems to be rather stable, this is a big advantage compared to certain competitors. because that means you can take a nice snapshot of your entire virtual machine. Backup is gone and the merge is quickly, meaning less resources, less load on your machines, less IOPS you need. So it's all an advantage. But it does mean you're going to have to start working with REFS. If you're not working with it yet, just spin up, even on your laptop, just get a drive somewhere separate, run it, do some tests, it works rather well. If you see the speed they can do on a stupid laptop, imagine what it can do on a server with some heavy storage behind it. Some other improvements, PowerShell Direct. If you're aware with VMware, I call it the answer of Microsoft to VIX. What does it do if you're actually connected on the host? It will give you the possibility to do remote PowerShell directly in the virtual machine without having a network connection. What does it mean that if this one is in a different virtual LAN, a virtual LAN which the host does not have access to, you still can do remote PowerShell inside. Of course, you need to have credentials. It's not that you can just break in without credentials, without actually needing to have the access to the network. So in issues when there is network disconnects or you need to troubleshoot, this is rather interesting as an additional search. But it works for many other use cases as well. One of the things backup vendors, again, yeah, I do work for backup, that can do with VIX, with VMware, is literally they don't need to have access to the work, but they can still do guest indexing because they can go directly. Microsoft now delivers as well. So think about this. This is a very interesting, and it's rather easy. It's almost exactly the same as you would do with PowerShell remoting. It's just a little change in the command line. I'll come back to that one a little bit later as well when we're working on the labs. So, we're not going to do this lab. I'm going to continue and make sure this module is done so we can have a lot of time in the labs after each other. Let's talk about containers. And container is rather difficult to explain, right? So, I'll do my best to explain. So, containers is not really something new. It exists already quite a while, but it didn't really exist in Microsoft world, right? But even if you look at application virtualization, there were already certain third-party vendors that offering application virtualization for years already. Containers is just the next step now. Again, it's a buzzword, you hear it everywhere, and Microsoft jumped onto that bandwagon as well. The idea behind it is right, what you can see here. Many years ago, and probably still, we use physical servers, which in most cases had a one-on-one relationship. One fixed box costing you X amount of euros, dollars. You run an operating system on it, you run a workload on it, and 90% of it never got used, all the resources, which meant that many people started to deploy more workloads on it, and you got some issues. Then the virtual came in. Virtual meaning we've got that box and we're going to put a lot of virtual machines, and every virtual machine has an operating system inside and a workload. Still rather simple, but you could run a lot more on one physical box. The next step is containers. And containers, what's going to do, and let's start with the physical, because there are two types of containers. You're going to still take a physical box, you're going to run an operating system on it, and then you're going to virtualize only the application. I use the word virtualize, although it's not 100% correctly, but you have to think about that you're going to run it into a user space on that operating system, which means you're going to share the operating system, but the applications will be shielded or quarantined or whatever you want to call it from each other. It also means, because it doesn't have an operating system. Remember, with the virtual, you actually have an operating system in that shielded thing. Here, you don't have it anymore, so you will get smaller packages, which also means your density will become better, and you will be able to run more workloads. Okay? Now, this is how you can visualize it. Okay? Let me just quickly say that. We've got a server. We've got a host operating system with container support. Which one will that be? Windows Server 2016. Previous versions won't run. You got a container management stack. I'll come back to that one, but there are different possibilities to manage your containers. And then you got a container which contains your applications, some bins, some libraries that actually use that host OS as well. Right? That's the simplest virtualization you can do. Very important about this one, if you start a virtual machine, what you need to do is you start it, it runs the operating system, starts the operating system, and then starts the application, right? Containers are simply the apps, which means the startup time will be way faster. So this is very good if you have those applications that need to scale out, scale back in, start some, delete some, those kind of things. Those use cases are containers very interesting for. Yeah, but it does have some downsides. We'll see that right here. Purely from a security perspective, a virtual machine is still way more secure. Why? You're isolating not only the application, but also the guest operating system. If we go back one slide, you see the operating system is the attack factor. If I can jump on this one and do some things, all of my applications don't work anymore, or I might even gone one step further and took ownership or did something nasty with it as well. Okay, so pure from a security point of view, virtual machines are still way more secure. From easiness, from fast booting, containers are better than virtual machines. When are you going to use containers? When are you going to use virtual machines? The theory says you're going to use a container when it's a workload that is stateless, no data inside. So think about, let's say we have our traditional application, which is a three-tier application. So we got a database, you know, to make Microsoft happy, I'll say SQL. We've got somewhere a middle tier, worker program, does some business intelligence, you know, does some smart stuff. And then we got, let's say, one website, and maybe depending on how big it is, and so on, right? Load balancer in front, and we're good to go. Now, what you see today in a traditional way of working is physical, virtual, depending on the machine, probably virtual, and then depending on whether you need to scale out, you just start some new virtual machines, you deploy some if you got mechanisms. But if the load today gets 80%, by the time you have a second started, it can take a while, right? In this scenario, if it's well written, and I'll come back to that one in a few seconds, I hope not too many developers in the room when I make my bad jokes, this is still going to be physical or virtual, depending. Can you virtualize every SQL server? No. There's still some configuration which doesn't go. This will be probably a virtual machine. Why is that? It will probably contain data, configuration files, those kind of things. And you have to think also that containers are throwaway. It's a box. You start it, you don't need it anymore, you throw it away, you delete it. So if there's data, you're probably still going to use a virtual machine. It also gives you the possibility to do snapshotting, exporting, backups, those kind of things, right? Those websites are stateless. What it is? IIS, maybe a config file inside, although that's bad practice. But it could be that the config file as well is here and they just read it out, right? And then the website gets the information from here, that gets it from the SQL. Really bad drawing here. This would be an ideal candidate for containers. Very quickly, start up, kill, depending on your needs, right? This one, maybe. If all of the data is somewhere else, then the worker process can still be an ideal candidate. Because, you know, not only the websites can get overloaded, the worker process as well. SQL. Some people say yes. I'm not convinced yet, honestly, because I am always scared if that container, the data inside, how you're going to manage that's going to be not that easy. Unless, of course, you will have a SQL engine running in a container that points to the data externally. That is also a possibility. All right. So, this is the virtual machines. Now, as Microsoft, this is Microsoft, and they literally say for distributed computing, for web, for tasks, for scaling out, they do say databases. I'm not really convinced of it today, but we'll see how it grows. But it's rather important. Now, I was going to come back to how your developers how need to write specifically for containers. Important to know is if your developers or if you're interested in using containers, that the development will need to be done so that this is a possibility to scale out, scale in as well. That probably means for many of these guys, they're going to have to change the way they write their applications, because you need to have deployment scenarios where you can take certain functionality out of the entire application and distribute it on different places. Yeah? So if you're going to start with containers, great technology, but make sure you talk to your vendors or your in-house development as well so that it is supported. Yeah? Maybe the best use case I can say today, I talked about IIS in containers. Not everything yet is supported in here. So if they're using certain functionality of IIS, that won't work. So keep that in mind when you want to look at it. For the ecosystem, this will require a bit of different thinking. Although if you use virtual machine manager, you're probably going to see something. But you've got your container runtime, and it's going to run either on a Windows server or on a Linux box. And then you're going to have certain container images. In the labs, you will create one or two, if I'm not mistaken. At least one. Not sure about the second one. And what you're going to do is you're going to have a base image. It's going to be server core or nano server. I'll come back to nano server also, I believe, next topic. And there you're going to create from there an image. You're going to put IIS in it. Maybe you want to put DNS in it. Whatever you want to do it, you create that image. And that's the one you're going to start. And then you got an image repository. And that repository is where you're going to withdraw things to build that image. Now, this is something that the open source world knows very well, these repositories. If you're going to look at the internet and you're going to Google or Bing to those repositories, you're going to see a lot of Linux distributions which have predefined application workloads on them. You just download that repository, you open it, you adapt it to your needs, and your first image is built. Microsoft today, of course, steps into the game, but you won't find a SQL server or something yet on that repository. Will it come? Probably. When? I don't know. Okay. Now, Microsoft has two types of running containers. Windows Server or Hyper-V containers. This is what they say. So for a Windows Server, really running your applications on a box without Hyper-V between it, they say hosting, automation, security, and so on and so on. And the moment you're going to work with the Hyper-V container is when you have public multi-tenancy. Why is that? Because you're going to go one server, some virtual machines on it, and inside those virtual machines, you're going to run containers, which gives you actually the best of both worlds, because suddenly you've got that security from the virtual machine and you got the containers. I believe the next one should give me somewhere. No, I'll come back to it. Wait, I still have this. Here we go. All right, so let me quickly see if I can bring that back somewhere. I thought I had a good slide around it, but no. All right, unfortunately, no. So just for the takeaway for, I was hoping I had a better slide on, but I don't. For the takeaway about containers, Windows Server literally is going to run it on 2016 and no virtualization layer on top of it, no Hyper-V. The Hyper-V containers, what you're going to do is you're going to build your Windows Server, you're going to deploy Hyper-V on top of it, and then you're going to save virtual machines and inside the applications. But just to make it extremely confusing, you can start mixing and matching, which means if this is your server 2016, then you can run Hyper-V. You can run virtual machines. And in those virtual machines, you're going to run containers. This is taking the best of both worlds. The security of the virtual machine. Think about shielded virtual machines as well at that point in time. And the containers, right? Nothing will stop you from running containers as well straight on that server. So mixing the Windows server with the Hyper-V container. But that makes it a bit confusing. Yeah, it supports. It's supported for now. And it works, actually. I've been doing some testing, and for now it works. You never know with Microsoft that they break something. Sorry, Sigrid. Important to know as well is if you're going to start developing for containers that it doesn't matter which you choose. So it's not that you're going to have to take a decision now, what am I going to run and go to my developers? It's going to be that or that. If they deploy something for containers, it will run on Hyper-V container. It will run on Windows Server container. And it will run on container technology in Azure also. So they don't have to rewrite, they don't have to make changes, it all works. And don't forget Microsoft's big dream. This is their dream, this is not, well, they made a nice marketing slide around it, but it is their dream. You've got their three clouds, right? You got on-premises, you got Azure, and you got a service provider, a hoster, whatever you want to call it. If you're running a container here, in the long run, will it work today? Not at least without downtime, but in the long run, you will need to be able to move it here, and get it back whenever you need it. And vice versa, in every direction you want to. So everything you're building in that should be portable to any other as well. All right, how are we going to manage it? Three ways. Well, actually, two that are known today, although there's a third one as well. One is if you have been working in the container world for a couple of time, you probably know Docker, or at least you've heard of it. If that is your choice of management, they're working together with Docker, they're building into their APIs, you can use it. I personally never worked with Docker because I do everything through PowerShell. Why do I use PowerShell? Simply because everything else I manage in my Windows Server is done through PowerShell. So that makes it easy for me. But if you have Linux administrators that's been using Docker already for some time, that will work as well with Microsoft. And then we'll have others. What others? We know a few third-party vendors today that are working on graphical user support, graphical user interface support for those containers as well. Five9 is amongst them. It's one of those tools that will make sure that you don't have to do everything through PowerShell or through Commons. But that is probably for GA. As you can see, you are going to exercise ALAP as well. In the meantime, let me quickly check if I already have internet. It actually looks good. All right, let's continue now and let's talk NanoServer. NanoServer, which I'm very passionate about, the reason being, this is the future. You can ignore this for now if you want to, but I would not advise you to ignore it. This is where Microsoft is heading. This is what they're doing. This is what I've been told by the customers. It doesn't matter. It's not that important. But in the end, if we have a Windows Server today, even if it's a virtual machine, and we need to reboot, it takes some time. Everybody loves Patch Tuesday, I assume, and everybody does Patch Tuesday, and then you are offline, and so on, and so on. Important is that Microsoft took all of these considerations and built something from the ground. So Nano Server is seen together with 2016, but it's actually a new operating system. So forget about this. This is what we have, or what we're going to have with Windows Server 2016. You will be able to run a full server with desktop experience on it, and then you go into Server Manager or you do PowerShell and you say, I want to deploy DNS, I want to deploy IIS, a feature and a role that you deploy. This is what we do today. Same thing with Server Core. Server Core never been that really popular, although I think it's a very good option that you can run in your infrastructure, especially since you had in 2012 R2 the possibility to downgrade from a full desktop, you configure it, and then you say remove UI. 2016, unless they still change that by GA, we're having separation again. So you're going to start with core, or you're going to start with the full desktop. Is that a good decision? Don't think so. So I hope they change it. And then we got Nano Server. And Nano Server is the smallest new installation option. It's actually not even an installation. Forget about next, finish, and then go grab some coffee and come back. Doesn't work anymore. You're going to build an image. You're going to use PowerShell. You're going to use DISM. It's completely different. Important to know is that this is a very small kernel, and if you deploy one, you've got literally nothing. You've got an operating system that runs, and that's it. You can't do anything with it. So you're going to have to deploy packages that live outside the operating system. It also means that if you deploy your first Nano Server, you'll see it's less than 500 megabytes. Is this the answer to VMware ESXi? Maybe you can look at it like that, but it can do way more. It's not only a hypervisor. Take that into consideration. We are going to do again an exercise where you're going to see how you're going to deploy it, and it's PowerShell. But you'll see that the moment you start working with it, and again, I'm really passionate about this, it's really easy. You need to do it 1, 2, 3 times, and they're going to say, that's it. Let's just use this. Why is that? It's got some key roles, some key features, and so on. And you know what? Maybe I can... What time is it? I still have time. Maybe I can just quickly show you something here. Change of plan. You can already see now at the slides that Nano Server has different roles than Hyper-V alone. So if you're thinking about scale-out file server, if you're thinking about IIS, if you're thinking about DNS, today they exist already. Just imagine that you're going to build your core infrastructure on a very tiny operating system, DNS, IIS. Personally, I hope that DHCP, Active Directory, all will become valid packages on that Nano model. Does it exist today? No. But DNS didn't exist in TP3 as well, so you see that they're growing over there. Now, the only thing I have here is, where is my PowerShell? Here we go. Yeah. All right. Wow. Let's see if I can quickly... No? Why aren't you doing Zoom? Unfortunately. But let me just run through it. If you're going to look at deploying, what you're going to do is you're going to load a PowerShell module. The moment the module is loaded, yes, I hope it will be automatically loaded in next versions, but today it's an external one. You load it, and then you're going to say new Nano Server image. And that's literally what you're going to do. You're going to build an image that you will be able to use physically or virtually. And then you're going to say, well, I'm going to choose my media path, which is basically where is my ISO, where are the data. And you're going to create a base. The base is going to be that Nano Server of almost 500 megabytes with nothing installed on it. That's going to be your base version. Because after you do this once, the second time you don't need the media anymore. unless Microsoft makes an update to the media and you need a newer version, but then you don't need it. And then you're simply going to give it a computer name, and you're going to say guest drivers or OEM drivers. Guest drivers are the virtual machine drivers of Hyper-V. OEM drivers are exactly the same drivers that will be in Windows Server 2016 core version. So most standard hardware will automatically be in there. Now, if you've got fancy hardware, the latest of the latest, you're probably going to have to upload those drivers, but that is possible as well within that script. And then if we're quickly going to jump to advanced, you can see right here that my script becomes a bit bigger. I just am giving it additional information. For example, I'm saying dash clustering dash compute, which means I'm building here compute is Hyper-V, clustering is failover clustering. I'm just adding that package to that base image. Yeah, I'm giving it dash domain name. I automatically joining it in the domain. I give it IP addresses, and I actually upload some tools and scripts as well directly to the machine. But this is the way you're going to start deploying a Windows Server. No more next, finish. The moment it's running, start deploying everything. You build it before it actually gets launched. Completely different way of working. Is it difficult? Well, the first time you look on it, you probably want to open the window and throw out your computer. Second time, it's a little bit easier. The third time, you wonder why you weren't using this before. It's not that difficult. Now, for those that are using in their infrastructure for years, tools such as unattended.xml, DISM, setupcomplete.cmd, and I'm probably forgetting a few more, they still work. You still can use that as well. But you can do everything up front before it's ready. What are you going to get? Today in TP4, you have the possibility to create a VHD, which is a Generation 1 virtual machine, or a VHDX, which is a Generation 2 virtual machine. And then you're going to use the VHD or the VHDX to deploy it on a physical server as well. Do you prefer to work with WIM to deploy it to a physical box? That is possible as well. But then after you have created, you need to do a little conversion. Again, is that difficult? No, you start the script and it will do the rest out of its own. But you still need to do it. So today with those scripts, we can only build VHDs and VHDXs. Yeah? All right. I already said, this is probably one of my favorites. Today, if you run Windows Server, Defender is installed. It's there, whether you want to use it or not. With Nano Server, this actually becomes a package. You want it, you deploy it. You don't want it, leave it out. Your choice. So again, just an operating system, nothing in it, and you choose what you want to put in there, okay? I already talked about it, so the scripts are included. This is one of these examples. In this case, what I do is I create a virtual machine or a virtual disk called Server Nano, give it a computer name, guest drivers, storage, clustering. So this is a Hyper-V. No, actually, this is not a Hyper-V. This is a scale-out file server with failover, and having guest drivers to run as a virtual machine. Yeah? If we're going to look at it, this is what you get. Going back to the good old DOS from long time ago, but you basically have nothing anymore. There's no RDP. So if you're in panic and you want to RDP to the box, the only thing you can do here is log in, username, password, domain, and then change a bit of the networking, change the routing, and change firewalls. Why do they have built it in? Only to make sure you have connection again. And the moment you have connection, you're going to use other tools to fix whatever's wrong. Okay? But that's all it can do. Nothing more. Not much. But if we're going to look at it, the file size, as I said, is 486 megabytes. If you put clustering on it, if you put Hyper-V on it, then it's 520 megabytes. Which means your C drive, by default, is 4 gigabytes. Dynamic, by the way, not even expanded. You can make it bigger if you want to, but that's an option again in the script. but 4 gigabytes is the maximum. And if you look at it running, and this is not a joke, it's an operating system that runs with no rolls, of course, on 163 megabytes of memory. When I deployed my Hyper-V cluster in our labs, we decided to go as low as possible, and we were able to run an entire 64-node cluster, each on 256 megabytes, and it had no issues. Of course, we couldn't start any virtual machine on it because we didn't have memory for it, but it was perfectly possible. So you receive a lot more resources that are otherwise stolen away by the full-blown Windows servers. Now, I know many people will say this is great, Hyper-V, clustering, and so on. And this is probably going to be the first use case that many people are going to use it for it. But think about those other packages as well. Think about DNS, think about EES, to give those resources away. Of course, there are some downsides. I'll come back to those in a second. Now, I talked about the Nano Server Recovery Console. You saw that, the black box. You are going to play with it as well in one of the labos. Nothing much to do, and the way to navigate is tap, 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 enter, arrows. Literally does not exist anymore. Okay? Back to the good old 80s or something like that. The biggest question, of course, if you can't RDP, if there's no UI on that machine, how are you going to manage it? Yeah. I already said these are some features, so you can see you can run containers as well. So let's think back on this one and imagine that this is a nano server where you're going to run containers on it, or even a virtual machine with containers on it. It's all about downsizing those resources, right? Today, what we have is Hyper-V failover, file server roles, Defender, as I said, the drivers. Reverse forwarders is a special one. I would not advise you to use this in a production, but it's basically something where you can test whether your legacy applications run on Nano. And this is rather interesting if we talk about Nano. And that means you have to go back to your developers. MSI does not work. The way you're going to use or deploy applications is by using AppX. Now, AppX you might know from Windows 10, because that's what happened in the Microsoft Store. You deployed something, it's a .appx. There is some difference. The AppX you're going to deploy on Nano is going to be server AppX. There is some differences, some more possibilities. However, it needs to use the new .NET 5, some core CLR, so there are some changes. And will you be able to run every application, every workload, or port it to Nano today? No. If you look at the libraries in .NET 5, specifically for Nano server, you'll see it's missing things that you can do on a full-blown server. But it is something that many of your developers are going to have to look at it, because if you can deploy it or develop it in an AppX, it will work on a full-blown server, it will work on a core server, it will work on platform as a service in Azure. And AppX has some advantages over MSI, because when you got MSI and you install something and you uninstall something, are you 100% certain that everything is clean? Not even close. AppX is completely different. If you say I remove an AppX, everything is gone. Downside, of course, if you have config files or something, they're gone as well. But so again, something that can be discussed with your developers. Are we going to step into that path, yes or no? Especially for worker roles, front-end, it can be a very interesting functionality. Will it happen over a couple of months? Will all the vendors be ready in a couple of months? No. But, you know, it will come as it grows, I'm afraid. All right. DNS, already said, is one of those I'm really interested in, because I'm really looking forward, more or less, my home lab to be able to run DNS, IIS, DHCP, Active Directory, all on this 8 gigabyte stupid machine. That would save me a lot of resources. Today in TP4, you are able to manage Nano with Virtual Machine Manager. There are some third-party vendors as well that can support it already. If you want to use Operations Manager, that works as well. There's a special agent, but then you have to have System Center Operations Manager 2016 Technical Preview 4, and then you can push an agent to Nano Server. You can also use it for data center bridging. MPIO is supported, and there's already the API to use Windows updates. There's only one downside in TP4. If you want to push Windows updates to Nano Server, you still need to manually force it. I assume that will change as well. How are you going to remotely manage it? Well, there's a lot. But it requires a change of mind. Most of the work you're probably going to do through PowerShell, remote PowerShell, or direct PowerShell if they're deployed as a virtual machine. Can you still use your GUI tools that you know today? Yes, if they support that remoting. Server Manager today mostly works to a Nano server. Some things still don't work, but that should be fixed by GA. Event Viewer, you can start Event Viewer on your local Windows 10 and then connect remotely to the server and get everything you need. Unfortunately, in TP4, there are still certain events which are not implemented, so if you got errors, it's not because you did something wrong, it's because it's just not there. Again, they're working on it. Most of the things you will be able to do with your tools, but not on the box itself, so you need some sort of management server or install all of the tools locally on a workstation. Yeah? What doesn't work is, logically, you can't change network remotely. Well, you can, but then you got to disconnect, right? So think about that one. Then you can use that black screen that I showed you, or PowerShell Direct, or some of those things. What I personally have done now to start learning it, to start forcing myself to use PowerShell, because that's another thing, if you still have the UIs, it's so easy to quickly start it, is I create scripts. And what I do is literally something like this. Now, this is just a small thing, but I literally have this ready in case I need to use it. I can use SIM, I can use WinRM, PowerShell, and then all of the other tools as well. But do I know this out of my head? Unfortunately, no. But I have them ready somewhere in an ISE to start working with them. But you can see most of it will be done remotely, and only in worst case you will need to jump to that box and do some fixing and then go back remotely. But Microsoft is actually bringing something else as well. It's called Remote Server Management Tool. I believe it's available today in Azure as a beta. It's not yet GA. What it gives you is in Azure some tools where you can do remote managing. It will give you Task Manager, Registry Editor, Event Viewer, Device Manager, all of the tools that you know, but straight in Azure. Which means, I always make the joke, it's Saturday evening, you're sitting at the bar, there's something wrong, your boss calls you, server down, instead of, you know, VPN and so on to get to your tools. You take your iPad, tablet, Surface, Android, whatever, you browse to the website, they will be able to fix it while you're still drinking your beer. Unfortunately, that would be great, but probably not. Important to know as well is this is not only for Nano. It will support Server Core and the full server as well. You do need a gateway in your infrastructure, and Azure will connect to that gateway and then talk to the different servers. So it's not that every server will need to have direct connection to Azure. It will go through that gateway. And of course, it's a subscription tool, which means you're going to pay per server you connect to the system. Don't ask me how much. It's still in beta, I have no idea. But it looks rather interesting to have that available in something, in case something goes wrong. Okay. I've been playing with it when it was private beta. There were still lots of issues with it. Now it's in public beta, and honestly, I haven't switched yet, so I can't tell you how good it is at this point in time. They said it changed a lot, so should be better at least. And as long as it's in a beta, you normally can play with it more or less for free. So might be the moment to start playing with it. Again, we're going to do a lab as well. All right. Let's continue. And these will be labs as well. And let's talk about software-defined storage. This is normally the moment I ask Didier to come up front to do everything, but I'll leave him alone for now. You've heard about it, right? Software-defined storage. Everybody's throwing at you, third-party vendors saying they have software-defined storage, although you have to buy their boxes. What exactly is this? The idea is that whatever storage you have, you put a layer up on top of it, and it will do the rest. That's the plan of Microsoft. Whatever you buy, you put a layer on top of it, and you can define the, that's the plan. I'm not saying it will work all the time. That also would mean, theoretically, you put a few USB boxes to a server, and you build a layer on top of it. Will it be fast? Probably not, but that's the idea. Now, most of us probably still use a storage area network. Very expensive, you handle with care, it gives you a lot of functionality and quality. If you're going to look at a storage area network, what it is, it's a bunch of disks in some arrays. You got some controllers, which is basically an operating system. Probably not Microsoft, but a Linux box, having some CPU, memory, and so on. And then you got your adapters that will give you that fiber channel connection for everything for speed. So what did Microsoft do? Well, exactly the same thing. We're going to build a server. We're going to attach some disks to it. Windows Server is the controller. We're going to give you some functionality like deduplication, like thin provisioning, tiering, and those kind of things. And the connectivity, we're going to work over networks preferred with RDMA, so you can get some decent speeds. If you're going to listen to the marketing story, then you're going to hear that Microsoft is faster than fiber channel of storage area networks. And theoretically, if you succeed in getting those 100 gigabyte network speeds, it is true. But you do need to have all the equipment to get to that speed, which is probably a little bit more difficult. But this is their vision. Yeah? How did they do it? In 2012 R2, well, it was a good start, but let's leave it at it was a good start. What they did is you had to build a scale-out file server. This one shows 2. You could go up to 8, if I'm not mistaken. And you built some boxes which had to be signed by Microsoft. So there were a few vendors that had those GBOT boxes, which you then connect to that scale-out file server. Then you build your Hyper-V cluster, and you're going to share that storage over SMB3 to your Hyper-V hosts. You deploy your virtual machines on it, and you're good to go. That was their first attempt. That was 2012 R2. Let's just say they had some issues. The issues coming from both sides. So this time, it's not only Microsoft's fault. On the contrary, most problems were with the hardware vendors who couldn't get their firmwares good. There were a lot of those vendors that built specific NICs for this type of systems, and they just didn't work as expected, which wasn't good. Now, if you're going to look at 2016, this changes. Completely changes in the idea that now they want to work with storage spaces direct. It's a new name. You used to have storage spaces in the previous architecture. Now it's called Storage Spaces Direct. Why is that? What they want you to be doing is buy a server with just a bunch of disks and use those combined with a couple of other servers and build a storage area network, if you can call it like that. Yeah. And then you're still going to have two different options to deploy it. There are people that are going to say, that's nice, I'm going to build a scale-out file server of a couple of these standard boxes, connect them to each other, and that will be my storage. And then I have my Hyper-V cluster, which is separate, that will, over SMB3, connect to that storage. Yeah? Or you can actually now bring everything together. You can say, where is it? You could say, I've got my boxes, I've got my storage in those boxes, I'm going to build that SMB network, that storage spaces direct, and I'm going to run the compute at the same time on these boxes, so everything is on the same cluster. Yeah? Is it cheaper than a storage area network? Because that's probably the reason why you would want to do something like this. Yes, it is cheaper, but don't think it is way cheaper. You still have to buy those network cards. You still have to have that storage. It still comes with a price. But it's a great new option that will be less expensive than a storage area network. It all comes together. But do keep in mind, you need to have the right hardware. And you also don't have all the functionality that a storage area network can provide you today. For example, hardware snapshots, they don't exist in this model. Maybe it comes later on, but not today. There is deduplication, there is TIM provisioning, there's parity, but the storage area network probably has a lot more functionality and options. So depending on what you need, you will need to make this decision again. Does it have enough for me today or not? Plus, and that's probably the most painful thing, if you want to deploy this and it's a green field, you start from zero, that's good. If you already have your infrastructure connected to a storage area network and you want to convert to this one, yeah, that's not going to be that easy. If you want this, you're probably going to have to set it up next to it, start fresh, and then do migration. Don't try to suddenly have connection to a storage area network, then implement on a couple of hosts this, bring it together. It's probably not going to work, or at least not good. You're going to have some pain, so keep that in mind. That being said, this is again Microsoft vision for the future, because what they see is they always think Azure minded, right? You've got four hosts in this case. If you want to deploy an additional host, you literally have to buy such a standard box, put it in, and everything else should be done by itself. Put one box here, new disks, and the storage pool just becomes bigger. You have a new Hyper-V host, you got more resources. That's the idea behind it. Okay. This is also the way Azure more or less works in the background. What we see today is that you can use SSDs, HDDs, and you can combine those. NVMe, which is rather newer, non-versatile memory. What? Non-volatile memory. Oh, Jesus. All those acronyms. They are supported as well. So you have some options. Then you have these hot and cold parts in that, which means everything which Microsoft considers hot will be placed on the SSD, so it's got faster I/O. And everything which it sees as cold going to be placed on the HDD, which is going to be bigger, more space, but less used. As an administrator, you do have some control over that. You can say, for example, this is hot. If Microsoft software does not see that it's hot, you can say, no, this is hot, I want it on the SSD. So you do have some control over it. Yeah. We're going to play with that as well. All right. Storage quality of service. In 2012, what you had the possibility to give a, I actually forgot, was it a minimum or a maximum that you were able to give?
The maximum was a hard limit, and the minimum was a warning.
Okay, yeah, so you could be able to say, I want the maximum of IOPS for this machine. That was hard. And the minimum was, I want it, but doesn't mean you got it. 2016, not R2, continues on that, and we'll make sure that you now have that minimum and maximum. This is again looking at it from a point of view as hosters. Just like you are going to have to look your own data centers as hosters as well. Who am I going to give what? Am I going to give accounting a lot of IOPS or not? Well, it depends. If they have to pay your wage, that's the moment, give them a lot of IOPS. If they're just doing some other stuff, don't give them that much. And you will be able to play with that. We'll be able to have that scheduling as well. It's going to be with policies, and those policies can be attached to a tenant if you really built it out as a service provider. A service, for example, you would say through Virtual Machine Manager and probably through some third-party tools as well, I've got a service called application A, which consists out of 10 virtual machines, well, this is the amount of IOPS they get. But you can also do it per virtual machine or per VHD. So if you got one server with multiple drives attached to it, you can create different policies. Let's see, what else do we got? So management, system center virtual machine manager, operations manager, or PowerShell. Is there a GUI for it? Not at this moment. Will it come? I don't think so. We didn't saw any plans whatsoever about the GUI. So if you want to use this, it's PowerShell. By the way, it's fairly easy, true. By the way, a lot of these things in 2016, there won't be a UI for it. Keep that in mind. It's all going to be, unless you use Virtual Machine Manager, of course, or a third-party tool, okay? Another thing, which is not on the slides apparently, but you will see in the lab as well, is that you really will be able to play with those policies. Think about, for example, a SQL server, where you would say, I've got a virtual SQL server and you got the C drive. And then typically, we've got a... It would be better, a logs drive and the data drive. Talk to your database administrators and define different policies for the different drives to get that speed you want and to get it guaranteed as well. Deduplication has improved as well. It worked, to be honest, rather good in 2012 R2, unless your files were terabytes of size. Yeah. Now, if you're going to look at Windows Server 2012 R2, they say, well, you know, if your volume was over 10 terabyte, it became dodgy. I've seen even worse, over 5 terabyte, and became difficult. And the reason why that, because it worked per volume, and you could only have one job per volume, and if it's too much data, it couldn't finish it within the 24 hours, which kept it in a loop. And every file above 1 terabyte, that was more or less the limit in 24 hours. So it was not possible to actually do it. And many people said it works on some file servers with small files, but if you have some bigger files, I got issues. Yeah? They improved that for Windows Server 2016. So every volume to 64 terabyte is now supported, not above. Reason for that is very simple. The deduplication uses VSS. And everything above 64 terabyte VSS does not work anymore. So that's a hard limit. They also make sure that you can do your optimization now through multi-threading, which means per volume you can have multi-threads to do all of your work. Of course, don't forget, it uses resources the moment it's doing its deduplication work, right? It can be used parallel now. And there's also now backup support. Many people asked, can we use a simple, cheap, I would say, Windows server with a lot of storage, use the deduplication on it, and then use it as a backup target? The problem with backup files is they're huge in most cases. Yeah, quite a few vendors are creating not workarounds, but new ways of working with it so that your backup files are smaller or split into different files, and have worked together with Microsoft to make sure that the duplication supports it. So it really becomes more stable to use it for different types of settings. And again, if you're going to do this, think REFS, because REFS and deduplication will be supported in 2016. Okay. Here it is. SMAPI interfaces, what does it mean if you want to manage it through third-party plugins? I'm not 100% sure anymore what SMAPI stands for, but it's a standard that you can use, so you can actually do provisioning and everything with deduplication as well through certain management solutions, okay? Good. Storage replica is something completely new. It's synchronous replication from one box to another box on the storage layer. Do know that Microsoft is going to support Hyper-V, storage spaces, deduplication, SMB3, all of those things. But also know that it's a synchronous replication. It does not have application consistency. It's crash consistent. which means on the other side, you will be able to boot up the server without any issues. But what happened with the application inside, it depends. If it's a log-based application, you might have some issues getting that application back up. If it's a standard workload, there won't be any issue. But do keep that in mind. It's a good technology, seems to be working not badly, but it's crash consistent. Yeah? Good. A few more guys, and then a break and some laps. You probably are getting bored of me already, and then you will have more or less 2 hours without me talking too much. So, software-defined networking, the first attempt in 2012. 2012 R2 is this. We have a Windows Server Gateway. That was 2012 R2, if not mistaken. And they had the possibility to virtual networking over NVGRE. Anybody ever used that here? It was terrible to create. Once you got it running, it was okay, but to get it running was rather painful. And it is a standard, but not many people used it. So it wasn't really that popular. If you're going to look at 2016, no, sorry, this is still 2012. So what we have so far is an extensible switch with some third-party vendors that did some stuff. You can do some as well if you know how to build with APIs and so on. Cisco 5.9, NEC, they all have some additions on it that you could do. You could do NIC teaming on the host. Right-click on the host or on server manager, say NIC teaming, and you could set it as well. It had SMB multi-channel, which was something new. Not that popular, although those that used it liked it. And you had SMB Direct that were using those RDMA-based NICs. Popular and not popular. Popular if it worked, it was great. If you had one of those NICs that took a long time to get it working, it wasn't that popular, of course. Yeah. And then you've got some hardware offloads, which in many cases either worked or gave issues with third-party vendors. There were some issues. Let's just say it like that. Physical switches just say the same thing. What Microsoft supports is OMI, the Open Management Infrastructure, to do all of your management remotely as well. We still see a lot of enterprises where people say, yeah, that's great, but I'm the network administrator. I will go to my own tools to manage and monitor it. I don't think that will change quickly. But the idea behind this is that you're going to do it from one point. This is just some marketing, so I'm not going to talk too much about it. But the idea is if you're going to use OMI, if you're going to use all these layers, that you could automate even the network building. Now, every time I talk to a C-level or a manager and say, how are you doing your network? Is this being deployed together with your Hyper-V hosts or with virtual machines that you're building? The answer was, nope, the network team does not allow it. If we want to deploy it, it's a ticket with the network team and they would take care of the rest. We're still not there. Virtual networking, I already said the NVGRE protocol. Why is that? Well, if you are a service provider, you want to bring in your customers. What happens today is you start building VLANs and VLANs and VLANs, and onboarding a customer takes quite some time. With network virtualization, they can bring their own IP. If you have a range 192.168.1 and you got the same range, you are two different customers, you could all go to that service provider, still use the same IPs, and you wouldn't see each other or you won't be able to touch each other's virtual machines. That's the idea behind that virtualization. Didn't really got that popular. Now, I'm going to skip this one, the gateway is not that important. If you're going to look at 2016, there are quite some changes. To start with, if you're going to do NIC teaming, you will be able to team now on the virtual switch. Not anymore on the host, but on the virtual switch. As of today, PowerShell, you can't even see it in the UI as well. I don't think they're going to change it. Or again, Virtual Machine Manager, or probably some third-party vendors as well. This is how you're going to do it. New virtual machines with the name, and then your adapters, your NICs, and then enable embedded teaming. That's it. That means you're going to take another layer away from the physical host. Yeah. So you can dedicate two network cards straight to the virtual machines without the host being able to use it or even does work on it because it's in the virtual switch now. Teaming modes, switch independent, we've got load balancing in there, management I talked about, and you can create up to 8 uplinks per team. One important note here, same manufacturer, same driver. Yeah, don't start to mix manufacturers, that will probably not work. And even if you're with the same manufacturer and it's the same card, make sure your firmwares and your drivers are exactly the same. You wouldn't be the first one that had two Broadcoms with firmware X and two Broadcoms with firmware A. It doesn't work. Why not? That's the reason. So keep that up to date. You're going to have that matrix. Also, something new is a network controller. The idea behind this is that you're going to get that to program to your network. But as I already said, most network teams will say, don't touch it. So this probably won't be deployed as much. But if you are the same team as the virtual machine team and you do the network and you do the storage, you might want to look at this because that means if you deploy a virtual machine, if you add a new host, you will automatically, through those controls, be able to do everything else as well. And if you have it in one script, in one PowerShell script, well, first, you don't make a mistake anymore. And second, you just start, you go for coffee, your boss is happy. How much work did you do? Well, my scripts. At least that's the idea of the future, okay? This is how it's going to work with some different APIs as well, okay? How exactly it's going to work, to be honest, I have not yet played with it. I know that it needs some changes, but it should be usable in GA all through APIs, which also means that third-party vendors will be able to jump on it. So imagine you got Cisco, you got Broadcom, you got whatever you are using. The idea would be that they integrate with this network controller. So from that network controller, you can control everything else. But as I said, doesn't always work like that. All right. Network function virtualization. The standalone gateway that you can use for doing the netting for the gateways and so on started from 2012 R2. They, of course, increased the functionality now for 2016. Unfortunately, I have never seen it in the wild or in a production environment. A lot of labs, but never been seen using it there. It has load balancers, firewalls, antivirus, DDoS protection, all of that things can be done, again, software-based now, so you don't need to have those big boxes. Software load balancers, this is also something that comes from the story from Azure. If you're going to do some deployments in Azure, and we'll talk about in the afternoon, you will see that there are load balancers. Those load balancers will be, well, actually the code is coming to Windows Server as well. You see it kind of a double way. A lot of the things they learn from Azure, they put in Windows Server 2016. But by the way, a lot of the things they learned from 2012 R2 and now from 2016, they're bringing the other way around as well. So they're learning from two sides, okay? Data center, firewall. There's something new now. I haven't played with it yet. I still have to do it, but there's so much new thing in technical preview fuel for that I just don't have the time for it, if you got a job as well. That will give you a network layer-based firewall. Will you use that? This will be, again, a decision you're going to have to take. If you today have invested in quite a few firewalls, which you are not dead yet, but when you're going to be at the point that you're going to have to renew maintenance or new firewalls, it might be interesting to look at it. Do also, don't forget that everything here has been looked from the data center view. Scale out file servers, Hyper-V, virtual machines, containers. If you still have physical boxes, that might not be a solution for you. Right? Yeah, it might. But it's all there. It's literally in there, and it doesn't cost you additionally besides the resources. All right. Let me quickly see, how are we doing on timing? Oops, not good. That was not the idea. Actually, well, more or less good. We're at the resources. So what we saw this morning is a lot of new enhancements and way too much in Windows Server 2016. Today you have to learn the enhancements on the compute, resiliency, agility, how are you going to manage it, a new server, Nano, that you need to do differently. Then you have all these enhancements on storage and all of these enhancements on networking, and all which we have been doing for many years differently. The only advice I can give you is start using it today with TP4 and see what you can use for yourself. If you want the entire software-defined data center as Microsoft will have with 2016, start with a greenfield. Don't try it in the production environment you have today. That will give you a lot of headaches, a lot of work to do. On the other hand, GA, when it's going to be GA, we are gambling by the time it's Ignite, but we're not certain, of course. A lot of the new functionality will be interesting for your data center, but start working with it today already. Start changing the way you're managing it. You'll see in the labs, not for the viewers online, of course, but those that are going to do with the labs, you're going to see that it's PowerShell. You're going to see a lot of PowerShell and not many UIs anymore. That means we need to change thinking, right? If you're going to play with Nano, again, I love it. I'm very passionate about it. I see a lot of solutions and use cases for it. Change your mind, okay? That being said, I think it's time for a break now. Thank you for listening enough to me. For the viewers online, we are going to go offline until after dinner, which I think will be around 1:30, if I'm not mistaken. And then we'll come back with everything what's new in Azure. And for us, we're going to start building some labs. So I say we take 15 minutes break for some coffee and something else. And then we're going to start doing some working. And I can stop talking. All right, let's go.